Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. Okay, tonight our 40-minute speaker is Eric, a very special guy from Dana Point.
My name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here. So, what time do I until? 9:25. That's 45 minutes. All right. It's good to be here. It's great to be sober, and I want to thank Kathleen for asking me to be here. She did not tell me I needed to be CD worthy. I didn't bring the A game tonight, but I'll see what I can do. I also want to thank her for seeing to it that I feel sort of nervous and self-conscious for the next 45 minutes, 40 minutes. I have always been tremendously conscious of self. It's been painful. It really has been. And I'll get into that more later on. It's not so bad these days. But let me start off by saying that my sober date is January 19th, 1996, which makes me 17 years sober. A couple things I will say. I'm not sure that's applause worthy, but thank you very much. I appreciate that. But what I meant, it's like the middle of the year. It wasn't like it was just my birthday. I mean, that's what I meant by that. But I've been sober. I've been in AA the whole time I've been sober, and I did not get sober until I came to AA. I want to say that. I'm going to start off by saying this. What I talk about tonight, I'm going to talk about my experience. I'm going to tell you what happened, sort of what happened when things went south and how I got sober and what it's like being sober now. I'm going to, again, give you my experience. I'm going to try to stay away from opinions. If I do give an opinion, I apologize in advance and I'll try to tell you it's an opinion. I absolutely encourage anybody who's new, and by the way, if you're new or relatively new, you're the people I'm really sharing here for. And the people I'm sort of kind of trying to talk to. I would sort of suggest you try to listen for the things that you find, listen for the similarities instead of the differences. It's a cliche, but a really important one in AA. So let me start by saying that I come from a really loving and actually really wonderful family. I'm not just saying that. I have the kind of family that even my friends say is, they're wonderful, really nice people. My parents have been married for over 40 years, and I only say that. I'll tell you some other things about it, but because I can think of no reason, I can't validate the fact that at a very early age, I became uncomfortable in my own skin. I don't know how exactly to explain it. Alcoholism does run in my family on my mother's side, but my mother and father, neither are alcoholics. My mother did grow up in an alcoholic home, and there are certain emotional patterns that are sort of passed down. You know, she didn't come out of that unscathed, but I really had a wonderful upbringing. I was never in need or want of anything growing up. I'm lucky enough to sort of have every opportunity. And again, I cannot make reason of the fact that ever since I was fairly young, probably 11 or 12 years old, I have been uncomfortable. I was a sensitive child. My mother always said I was sensitive. And that's where I'll start my sort of my drinking story. I had my first drink at a Club Med when I was 11 years old. I had four glasses of champagne. And mine is one of those stories where I remember the first time I drank. I'm not just saying this to be dramatic or to overemphasize it. I am one of those people who felt profoundly different. And I am also one of those people who really, I didn't know I needed a drink. I was only 11 years old. I had no idea I was uncomfortable. It was all I had known was the way I felt. But when I drank, I remember literally four glasses of champagne. Nothing bad happened. My parents took me to the hotel room. And all I know is I felt totally different, and I had this is what was going through my head. I had the feeling that this is how the rest of the world felt. I didn't realize I had been so uncomfortable until that moment, but I suddenly felt relieved, and I felt whole. Okay, I probably couldn't have said it back then that way, but the whole part. But I did say that, oh my goodness, I think this is how everyone else feels. And I felt like I had gained a sort of secret to life. I didn't think it had anything to do with the alcohol, mind you. I really thought just something happened and I was having a good time and that I had learned some kind of a secret and that I'd wake up the next morning for the rest of my life, I would have that relaxed, free, confident feeling that I had, and that was obviously not to be the case. When I woke up the next morning, I don't remember being hungover, but I just felt like I used to feel, which wasn't horrible yet, but it was uncomfortable. And the thing is, I was starting to realize that because I had a sort of experienced a feeling of comfort, I realized, oh my goodness, I'm uncomfortable. I started drinking on a regular basis when I was 12 or 13 years old, on a regular basis, like on weekends and stuff like that. I grew up in the Boston area, a little suburb of Boston called Brookline. Anybody? All right, nice. And it's a really nice little place. I would steal alcohol from my parents a little bit on weekends, and we'd drink and do all that stuff. And I loved it. I started drinking, and drugs are a huge part of my personal story. I'm not going to go into them in any detail. I've been sober a long time, and in case you're new, I'll say this now. You can be an alcoholic and also have had a tremendous experience with drugs. That doesn't mean you're not welcome here at all. There's a bunch in my story that isn't just about alcohol, but I don't go into detail in a lot of those things. I'm going to tell a little bit about, very vaguely about some my drug history, and I'll speak vaguely about certain other patterns, like really dysfunctional relationships and stuff like that in my story, because it's a big part of it, and it helps tell the story of how things got bad and how they got better. Suffice to say, I did start smoking pot on a daily basis when I was about 12 or 13 years old, too, and did that every day. But drinking was a weekend thing for me, and I loved it. I'm going to tell you that the way I describe my alcohol, like my buzz, what I liked about it, I hear a lot of times people say when they took that drink, they felt water. Hold on a minute. This better be reverse osmosis distilled water. I'm totally kidding. But the way it affected me, a lot of people say that they felt that suddenly they were the best looking person in the room. They felt like they were 6 feet tall. None of that happened. To me, what I found profound about my drinking experience is that, what happened to me when I drank and the buzz was right, was that, I thought you were trying to get my attention. What did I do? what happened to me is that I didn't become different. What happened is that I became okay with the way I was. I just felt all right, which to me is a more profound experience, I think. It's more profound than thinking I was better than I was. I just was all right. I didn't worry. I felt relieved. I felt relaxed and comfortable in my own skin. These are not things that you won't hear a lot of times in meetings. But it's going to become important, because what's going to happen later on, it's a little bit of a spoiler alert, is that I'm going to try to get sober without actually doing anything for recovery later on. And it's really, really hard, because I felt so profoundly uncomfortable. And then later on, when I get sober, I found a way to be comfortable. That's the basis of my story. But I'm going to go back and talk about it. That's what happened is when I drank, I felt okay. Felt all right with everything for the most part. And it was almost like a magical experience. I drank a lot, probably 2-3 days a week, until I was 16 years old. I met a girl when I was 16. I've met girls before, but I met my first real girlfriend. I've had a couple others before that. But first, I spent summers on Martha's Vineyard. Anyone? Yeah. All right. Yeah. Good. I'd still actually go back there for a week every year. But I spent summers there, and I was driving. I just got my driver's license, and I've been driving, and there was a girl with her thumb out in the road, and I picked her up hitchhiking, and we fell in love over the course of the next 45 minutes, and decided that I'd drop out of school and live with her, because she was a little bit older than me, and only a little bit. I'm not saying that euphemistically. She's a couple years older than me. She had just been deported from Canada for dancing in a strip club underage. But the point is, she had great credentials, and she's great. Her name is Jennifer O'Neill. I can say that. She's not around here, and there's a million Jennifer O'Neills in the world, and you won't believe this, but she was Irish, and she loved to drink. And she, I'm not by any means blaming anything on her. She was not a bad influence on me. I needed nobody to influence me. I want to make that really clear. But what she did teach me is that you really can drink every single day. And at least I thought, and it looked normal to me. It looked okay. She didn't look like she was in any grave trouble. She still looked pretty good. And she really did. And I realized then that I had been holding myself back from drinking as often as I wanted to, because it just seemed like it was probably a bad idea. I dropped out of high school, explained to my parents, both of whom just assumed since the day I was born that I would be going to high school and then college and then I'd, you know, get some kind of a normal job. My parents are so far from boring, but they're very conventional, though. They're not boring at all. Very interesting people, but conventional. And they assumed I, too, would be conventional, and they were to be sorely disappointed. But they're not actually disappointed in me at all. But what happened was I told them I'm going to drop out of school. I'm going to live with Jennifer O'Neill. And they said, okay. Yeah. Well, actually, they tried to stop me. But they realized very quickly that they couldn't. And they said, you know, Eric, I remember they said, we don't think it's a good idea, but we're also not going to stand in your way. You know, we want to be close to you and all that stuff. So I started drinking on a daily basis, getting drunk on a daily basis when I was 16 years old. Moved into a little place in Alston. All right. Yeah. Keep pointing at you. Yeah. All right. And I started drinking every day, and I loved it. J.J. Foley's in Boston? No, too bad. It's a great bar. There's one. I have this vision. I drank at Foley's. It's a little Irish bar that I became involved in the rock and roll scene. I say involved. I didn't actually play an instrument or do anything, but I did. I did drink a lot and go to bars, and most of my friends were in bands, and I lived in lofts with people in bands and stuff like that. And every now and then I'd carry a, you know, speaker or something like that. But I did become involved in the Boston rock and roll scene back in the 90s, and I'd go to a different bar every single night, but it was the same. Every Monday I'd go to one bar, every Tuesday I'd go to another bar, every Thursday, and I took actually I took Monday night off, so it was Tuesday through Sunday we went to the same bar, you know, six different bars, but the same every Tuesday, every Wednesday, and I started drinking every day, and I loved it. I had so much fun. I had a good time drinking. Alcohol, it served me well. It really, really did. It opened my eyes in some ways. It actually taught me a lot about myself. I mean, there were some, in a very dysfunctional way, okay, I got a lot out of drinking until it stopped working for me. I'll get there in a minute, or a few minutes. But I started drinking every day, and I loved it. I did do a lot of drugs, but mostly it was alcohol. I mean, I smoked pot every day, but that's just like, for me, that was like breathing. You know, I don't know. It was just kind of something I did. But, and I just loved it. I really, really did. And I remember Jennifer once saying to me, she said, "You know what, Eric? Alcohol is God." You know, that was when we were first dating, and I realized that, I just thought that was pretty cool. So, it didn't end up working out for me and Jennifer. But we were together for a long time, and we still talk sometimes now. But the relationship didn't work out. We got in a lot of fights. Things got pretty dysfunctional. Get in fights, she'd throw things at me. You know. I have a couple interesting stories from those times, but I don't think I'll tell them. Maybe I'll tell some stories later on. But I started moving around after that. I did go back to high school, by the way, for a year. Okay, so I got down to 16, left for a year. Things didn't work out with Jennifer O'Neill. I went back to school. I went for another year, finished my junior year of high school, and then dropped out for good, never to return again. I did go back to school in my sobriety, so spoiler alert, I do. I have a graduate degree, so I'm a high school dropout with a master's degree. I think that's a great combination, personally. But I'll get there in a minute. But at the time, I left school, and I started moving. I had met... You'll see a small pattern of me making very quick decisions after I had met, you know, there's a few women I've met in my life, and then like that, I would just stop what I was doing and change my entire life for them. And that happened again. I was sort of floating around. I was living in Boston, living in a couple places, and then I had met a girl a couple of years before. We spent like you know, 14 hours together in New Mexico where I used to ski. And so I decided to move to New Mexico. I had no idea whether I'd see her or not, but I figured, you know, maybe I would. And I did enjoy New Mexico, and I moved to Taos. Anyone? Taos, New Mexico? All right. There's some hands. Good. And Taos is a great town. I absolutely love it. I could, if there was an ocean near it, I would probably live there again. But I moved to Taos, New Mexico. I got a season ticket for the ski mountain there, and I skied a lot, and I worked at a little bar restaurant at the bottom of the ski mountain, and it was a great setup. I would ski until 3 o'clock all day long, take the skis, put them in the actual place that I worked, change into my shoes, and then start washing dishes, prep cooking and stuff. And I loved it. I had a really good time. I drank a real lot. Drinking was absolutely okay where I worked. It was one of those places where you just tell them I want a beer, and they put it on a tab, and which is, it's kind of depressing at the end, because then they just automatically take it off your paycheck. And you know, and we drank a lot and did a lot. I mean, it was snowing in that kitchen, let me tell you. We did a lot of cooking. And it's sort of when I started getting into that really bad. And what happened was I skied a lot, but then slowly I became more interested in the drinking. And I wasn't as interested in the skiing, but also it got difficult. Because I was so hungover all the time. I did run into that girl again, and then we kind of started a little relationship up. What passed for a relationship, what passed for romantic involvement and interest for me at the time anyway. So we're doing that, and I ended up selling what was left of my ski pass to somebody and because I wasn't using it. And we had decided, again, just like that, to move to Hawaii. Now, I know it's no big deal. You guys live in California, go to Hawaii. To me, this was like this, you know, sort of paradise, I hoped and thought. She was living in Albuquerque at the time. I was in Taos. She moved there faster than me because she robbed a bank at gunpoint and just took the money and left, literally. Yeah, she was that awesome. Literally. She really was. She was just a beauty. She was just a dancer and a bank robber. So she moved there, apparently not getting enough money for me. So I moved back to Boston for a while. I worked as a telemarketer for a little while, and then I moved there. I moved there with $1,000, a one-way ticket, and the relationship did not work out. It did not work out. To this day, I'm amazed. It seemed like everything was going to be in place for us to have sort of a deep, meaningful, and sort of, you know, perfect love affair, but it didn't. It didn't work out. $1,000 didn't last nearly as long as I thought it would either. That was about. We had a good time for like 4 days, and then the money ran out. And I'm sure it's completely coincidental that she kicked me out of the house too, right after the money ran out. But it's a coincidence, I'm sure. But so I wandered around Hawaii, literally just kind of wandering around. I was 18 at the time, and I hitchhiked around with a backpack. Luckily, it's all I had. I stayed in a bus, an abandoned school bus that was on a guy named Bear's property. And Bear did not even look like, you think Bear, right? You're thinking this big dude. Bear was a very tall, very skinny guy, a lot of tattoos. But Bear was a nice guy, and he let me stay in his abandoned school bus on his property. And I hitchhiked around and wandered around. Finally, my father talked me into allowing him to lend me some money to fly back to Boston. And I finally said, yeah, okay, I'll do that. I'll tell this story because she's not here. I'll tell it in honor of my wife. She always likes me to tell this story. For some reason, I don't know why. But so I was very broken up. This was actually, it really affected me greatly. I'm joking about it, but I was really torn up. Oddly, I did not, it'll surprise you, I'm sure, but I did not deal well with breakups and heartbreak at the time either. I really didn't. I had very, very minimal skills, and I was pretty much reduced to a sort of squabbling 2-year-old level. Especially when I was sober. Okay, and again, I was drinking every single day and getting drunk every day. This is a huge, alcohol is just such a huge part of my life at the time. And morning drinking, that started in New Mexico, actually. But anyway, so I'm getting on the plane to go back to Boston, and the plane is packed, and I look down, there's like one empty seat, and right next to that seat, that one empty seat, is this really good-looking blonde girl. And I was like, oh, no. So I'm trying to get my tears out of my eyes. And I had really long hair, and I'm like, okay. You know, and so, anyway, we hit it off. It was great. So I had a hotel room in California because I had to sleep the night there. She came over, spent the night in the hotel room with me, and we made a decision to hitchhike to Florida together. And she had a connection to get some crack. We could sell it there, and it was a great plan. I missed my plane the next day. Called my dad, luckily. I told him, you know, Dad, I met a girl. And, he seemed nonplussed. He didn't seem encouraged at all by this. I didn't tell him about the crack. But the point is that I kind of stayed till I had to check out of the hotel room, and I did realize, I was drunk, we had been up all night drinking, and I realized that this was probably not a good idea. And I told her that. And I begged my way back onto a later flight. They allowed me to go to Boston, and I planned on catching up with her later. And I am glad to say I never did. I never saw her again, which is probably a good thing. And what happened was I moved back to Boston, and I got a job there working in a couple of coffee houses. I lived in Boston, Cambridge, drinking all the time. I started doing heroin at that time, too. And that's important to mention because it was to be my getting sober thing. So this is the point. Sorry. For those of you listening to the CD, I just hit the microphone with my hand. It's important to explain these things because some people spend the rest of the time going, what the fuck is that? But anyway, I had to swear at some point since it's, you know, going to be taped for posterity. At some point, I ended up with a pretty mean heroin habit, and it happened pretty quickly after that time. And what happened was, again, this was to be the beginning of my, this is what I was saying. This is the part of my story where it's like, what happened? Okay, this is the what happened part. This is the beginning, not of sobriety, but this is the beginning of my journey to sobriety. I called my father, who worked in the financial district in Boston. I was working in South Station at a coffee shop there. And he worked near there. I said, Dad, I need to talk to you. He came over, and I said, you know, I told him, I said, I have a physical addiction to heroin. And he said, no problem. You know, you've got insurance. I was going to their health insurance. You can, this is back when insurance paid for things. And they're like, yeah, you can go to rehab. And both of us thought, problem solved. You know, problem solved. Go to rehab. It's a medical problem. Get detoxified. And I thought, and I thought this at the depth of my being, that what would happen is that I would go, I would get detoxified from heroin, and I'd be back to just the way I was before that, which was, that life would still seem dysfunctional, but it seemed normal to me. Okay, in that life, I'd be back to just drinking every night, you know, and not really doing any hard drugs, but just drinking every single night and getting drunk and hanging out and rock and roll scene in Boston and having fun, you know. And that is what I thought. And so I went to this rehab. I was to go back to that particular rehab two more times, but I went to this rehab, McLean's in Boston. And when I was there, I went in. They said, you know, why are you here? I said, well, I'm here for heroin detox. And they said, well, we really suggest that, you know, getting sober is a process whereby you give up all mind-altering substances. And I was amazed at that prospect. I did not think about following it for one second. I remember smugly, I oddly maintained the ability to be smug back then. It was ugly. Like, seriously, eventually I'm going to become homeless in a minute, and I was still smug then. But I smugly said, yeah, okay, I think not. I'm just going to, you know, get off the horse. I was like, nah, that's it. And the thing is, and this is important if you're new, I'm not, by no means am I telling you what you're, what you need to do, what you need to get sober, what your story is going to be. I am as far from a preacher, at least I want to be as far from a preacher as I possibly can be. Again, this is just my experience. But what happened was, I stayed in rehab not for long. I didn't stay that long. I stayed long enough, as long as I thought I needed to stay, and I checked myself out AMA. I had a girlfriend at the time, much less, actually, seriously, a less dysfunctional relationship. In fact, we got back together a long time later. That should come up too, and that's the reason I live here in Laguna Beach now, or in Southern California now. But she was not an alcoholic, and she misunderstood the nature of this condition as well. So She also thought I was going to go to rehab and get detoxified from this. She had a case of Samuel Adams. I don't know why I remember it was Sam Am, but it was. A case of Samuel Adams and a half gram of cocaine to celebrate my release from rehab. Literally. I got out of rehab. I found the stuff while she was at work, because she actually had a job. I did all the cocaine, drank all the beer by the time she got home, told her I lost the cocaine. And then what happened, and I was just right back where I was. It was, I was drinking so much more and more desperately. And here's the thing that really was a bummer, is that the alcohol, it's not that it didn't work, it did still intoxify me, but I didn't get the relief. This is where it totally, very, very quickly stopped working for me. And it was a real bummer, because I didn't realize it was such an important tool for me, and that I was maintaining my sanity through this, you know, but apparently I was. And I still didn't notice it then. I just remember I wasn't okay anymore, even when I drank. So I ended up in rehab again. Obviously, I'm going to sort of make it short. I've been to rehab over a dozen times. Never, except the last time, did I ever stay as long as I was sort of supposed to, as it was recommended. My life got different and worse. I went on what I like to call little drug diets, okay, because I was not thinking about getting sober. What I did in the beginning, as I said, is I just need to get off this one hard drug. Then I said, okay, I'll get off all hard drugs. Then I realized I really can't drink either, so I'm going to try to not drink at all. I'm just going to smoke pot. I tried all those little diets. I didn't stick to any of them. Maybe they work. I don't know, because I could not stick to them. But what I do know is that life got messier and messier. I was never able to stay sober, not at all, not for a day, literally. Between these different rehab attempts, these attempts at sobriety. And it is very important to say that not once did I ever contemplate or go to a meeting, a 12-step meeting. I was absolutely not going to go, and I'll get more into that in a second. But I was introduced to them in the rehabs, of course. And I just thought, I guess I'll say this now, I thought AA was not for me. I thought it was for... Not necessarily, it's not that I thought I was smarter and better than other people or anything, but I definitely thought I was different. And I thought that AA was for people who join groups. I thought AA was for people who are maybe not as complex as my thinking was. And I didn't mean it in a good way. It was like a bad complex, but it was a complex, you know. And I just, it just wasn't for me. I was sure that I was smart enough to take myself intellectually and put myself in what AA was, and it was just not going to work. So I didn't think about coming, but I never stayed sober. I could not stay sober. I was so miserable every single time I tried to get sober. I was so profoundly, profoundly miserable. And if I had been self-conscious, conscious of self as a young person, I was so much more conscious of myself in a very painful way later on, during those sobriety attempts, and I didn't get sober. I didn't get sober for a while. I eventually became homeless, and that's one of the becoming homeless at that, for some reason, was an easy transition for me to make. I have no idea why. I grew up in a very, very large, beautiful, you know, 200-year-old Tudor home in Brookline. You've seen the homes in Brookline. Mine was one of the bigger ones. But I was able to live very, at that point, I had lived in all kinds of weird, different situations, and I was pretty laid back about where I slept, and I was sort of squatting in this last place that I lived at with the girlfriend, the one that had the one that was kind of not that bad. She, the one that had the drugs and the Samuel Adams waiting for me. She left. She got in her car and drove. She drove to Laguna Beach, and she decided to move there, working a little record company in Laguna. And she did that, and it was a real bummer. We were broken up, and that was really, really hard for me. Never, even in my sobriety, maybe I'll get to that. I didn't deal with breakups and boys being a little difficult for me, but they were really difficult back then. And Adam's laughing because he's seen it in all its beautiful glory. But so what happened was I became homeless, and I stayed in that place as long as I could, and then I ended up on the streets. I slept mostly I just had a bunch of places. I slept in, you know, different places around Boston. I tried to stay in a homeless shelter, but that wasn't much fun. Obviously it wasn't fun. It just was difficult. I had to be in at a certain time. There were some rules which made it difficult for me to live my lifestyle. It was very hard. Sometimes when it was real cold, I would do that. I wasn't homeless for that long, less than a year. But it was really difficult. And the other thing that happened during that time is I started panhandling. I'd already been sort of stealing. I didn't do any great crimes. I was a criminal, but it was very boring everyday stuff. I really, you know, to this day wish, just for the sake of entertaining all of you fine people, wish I had some better, you know, sort of armed robbery or something like that. I don't. I stole a lot, but it was all nickel and dime crap, and I panhandled. And I panhandled in Central Square, Cambridge. Yeah. In the inbound where the commuter train was, or the T. And I stood there every single day for 10 hours a day and panhandled money. Until recently, that was the most money I made per day. Well, in sobriety, I'm afraid to say. And eventually, I got arrested. I was doing drugs again. I accidentally sold some heroin to an undercover cop. Apparently, in Boston, they frown on that. It was an absolute mistake. I meant to sell the heroin. I didn't mean to sell to an undercover cop. I got busted. It happened. I was in Cambridge. You guys aren't from Cambridge, but there are schools everywhere in Cambridge. There are colleges everywhere. Every block, there's some kind of a school. But there's also a law that if you're near a school, it's a 2-year mandatory sentence. So I got a 2-year mandatory sentence. I didn't end up doing it. But the point is, at the time, I was going dead to rights to prison for 2 years on my first offense. And it was a real bummer. Did not get me sober. Did not scare me into sobriety. I tried to go to rehab again, but I couldn't get sober. And I certainly wouldn't come to AA. So what ended up happening is that my parents got, somehow they got word to me. And by the way, my parents had, and I mean this, very lovingly told me that I could no longer call the house or stop by. If I stopped by the house, they would call the police, because if they didn't, I would walk into the house, I would take something that was worth money, and I would just literally, I just walk in, grab a video camera or something, and walk to the pawn store and pawn it. And I would always bring them back the pawn slip because I'm a nice guy, you know, but I would do that. And it was too heartbreaking, and my parents are really loving people, and they just said, you cannot come in the house. If you knock on the door, we'll call the police, and if you call us, we will hang up on you. And they did. They would allow me to, for my court dates and stuff, they would allow me to come. They'd walk me in the house, allow me to shower, and they'd walk me out, and I'd sleep on a futon between the cars. Cars locked, of course, in the garage. And that was just for court dates. And that was just the day before court dates. The saddest moments for me, they may not sound sad, but there were some days when I was homeless, some nights where I was, this was a very miserable time for me, and I want to make that clear. There was no fun and games happening anymore, and I was getting no relief from anything, from no matter how much I drank, no matter what else I did, I got no relief. It was a desperate, desperate, desperate time, and was for about a year, like really, really bad. It was desperate before that, but it got really bad. And there were nights sometimes where I would walk to my parents' house in the suburbs from Boston. I'd stashed a blanket near the garage where they couldn't see me, and I would sleep under the back stairs where I knew they wouldn't see me, just so that I could be near them, just so that I could be near home, you know. And it was a really, really difficult time. And it was the summer. We lived near a reservoir, so there were a lot of mosquitoes. And I remember being so miserable, just wrapped up under this. It was a poncho. It was a Mexican poncho, one of those Mexican blankets with a slit in it, which I still have. It's at my house now. And I was sleeping under there just so I could be near and have a feeling of home. You know, and I want to make this, my parents were loving about this. This was the hardest thing they had ever done. I had really put them through hell, and I have many stories. Eventually, they got word to me on the street. They said, we will put you through one more rehab, but you do it on our terms. They had gone to a therapist. Freaking therapist. I'm just kidding. I'm a therapist. But anyway, but they talked to someone, and this guy kind of, I remember him. I didn't like him. He worked in one of the rehabs I'd been to 3 times, and he did not connect well with me, but he did with them. And what he told them is, he is the reason they ended up setting a boundary with me and saying, you can't call, you can't come by. And he's also the ones that told them that if they're going to, you know, pay for another rehab, or pay for a rehab, because they stopped paying. Most of my rehab attempts were in indigent detoxes around the Boston area. Joe knows what I'm talking about, because we've been in some of the same places. But most of them were in these little indigent places around Boston. But they said, we'll send you to a nice rehab or a rehab, but you do it on our terms, and it's going to be across the country. And I wasn't, I still at that point, that sounded very excessive to me. So I said, okay, I'll give you a call if it gets that bad. And eventually, I guess it got that bad. So I called them up. And of course, they said you can call up, but all you're allowed to do is call up and say, I'll do it. You know, so I was like, okay, I'll do it. But they're like, no, you're going to do it our way or you don't do it. And I could tell they were serious. So I did. Again, slept between the cars, was allowed to shower. And my mother drove me to the airport. And this is when you could actually walk someone to the gate. And they walked me to the gate. She saw that I got on the plane. And I was picked up there and went to a rehab in Minnesota. And that was the first time I was to stay for as long as I was supposed to in a rehab, which was a long time, 28 days. Seemed pretty excessive to me. But I did. I stayed the whole time. And what happened was this was the first time that I ever went to tried to get clean, tried to get sober. It was the first time I'd ever done that without a plan and totally hopeless. I was sure it wouldn't work. It had never worked before. But usually I went in, as pathetic as it was, I'd go in with some fervor. I'm going to do this. This time it's going to work. This last time I didn't. I went in just broken and no ideas and sure that it wasn't going to work. And actually, that was different, and it was a good place. I mean, what it did is it allowed me to be at least a little bit teachable. So I went to this rehab, and they said, we suggest you go to a four-month halfway house, our affiliated halfway house in St. Paul, Minnesota. Again, this sounded very excessive, but I had nowhere to go. And here's a key difference, too, is that I had connected to a couple of the guys in my rehab, and I'd connected. I mean, I had talked, I had opened up, and I really cared about them, and I felt cared for by them. And that, and I'm telling you, is all the magic I needed to go to say, okay, I'll try this out, this halfway house. And to stay in that halfway house, you had to go to 12-step meetings. Now, I'd had to go, by the way. I had had to go in the past because I had had court cards and a couple other things that I had to do. And I obviously realized very quickly, you know, sorry, you don't know this, but you can sign your own court cards. At least I could back then, so I did. But this time, I probably could have, you know, messed with the system, but I didn't. I went to meetings, and this is the logic that brought me into AA. It's as follows: I had tried to kill myself. I didn't go into those stories because I want to get sober here, because I got like 9 minutes. but I've been locked up a couple times in psych wards as well, and I decided I'm never going to be able to get sober. I'm going to kill myself. I have no choice. But then I said, you know what? I know AA is not going to work, but I'll try it. And then when it doesn't work, I'll kill myself. And I'm not trying to talk about suicide lightly. Okay, I meant it. That was the level of thinking that got me to AA. I wasn't joking around. That was serious. Anyway, I came to AA. Glad I did. Because what happened was, in the beginning, it still seemed silly to me, but right away I could tell it wasn't what I thought it was. There were some pretty cool meetings and people in some of the meetings I went to. And I started listening. I certainly wasn't going to get a sponsor or work the steps. There was no way. After about a month, I said, well, maybe I could get a sponsor. I got a sponsor. I ended up relapsing. One day, I put myself with the best of intentions in a bad situation, and a situation I wasn't ready for, and I ended up, I drank. And that was my sobriety date back then. Again, it was just one night. I'd been sober and in AA for a few months, probably about 6 or 7 months before that, and I liked it. I didn't decide I wanted to go back out. Again, I kind of made a mistake, and luckily it turned out okay, but I did. That's my sober date now. At that time, I was starting to reconcile with that girlfriend that I cared so much about, the one that lived here in Laguna at the time. And we decided to try to be back together. I came out to visit. I liked it, and I moved out here because it was either I moved to Laguna Beach or she moves to St. Paul, Minnesota. And St. Paul's not a bad place. It really isn't, but, I mean, it's no Laguna Beach. And at that time, I had started working a program. And, I mean, I had started actually being involved in AA. The first night I came out here, a guy named Brad N. guarantee some people know him here. But anyway, he worked with my girlfriend at the time, and she's like, hey, I got a guy who's an A, he's going to take you to a meeting. So the first night I moved out here, I went to a meeting. And that is the biggest deal in the world. I've actually worked in some rehabs, and I always tell people, I'm like, the most important thing, I think the most important thing to do when you're trying to get, you know, when you move or you get out of a rehab is, for the people that go to meetings right away, and I mean the first day, what a great sign that is. And I did that. And I started getting involved in every single day I went to a meeting, you know. And this is what I really, you know, and by the way, I've been sober ever since. I got a sponsor and started working with the steps with that guy. And I had that sponsor for almost 17 years. He lives part-time in Florida now, and so I got a new sponsor a couple of months ago. Suffice to say that I got sober as soon as I came to AA, except for that relapse. You know, as soon as I did, and here's the big difference, and this is kind of what I was talking or alluding to earlier. When I started, before I came to AA, I would just try to sort of muscle my way into sobriety. I thought that sobriety was all about simply, the whole problem was the alcohol and certainly the drugs and all that stuff, but that was the problem, I thought. You know, and I love what you said when you took your happy birthday, all birthday people, especially Adam. Meant to say that in the beginning. And only especially Adam because I know him the best, not because I care. I mean, I'm glad you're all sober. But I love what you said about... Oh, shit. Now I can't remember what I love that you said. And I can't sit here because there's not enough time for me to try to figure it out. Probably come back to me. But I absolutely loved drinking, and when I stopped, I felt so displaced and so empty and so horrible, and I really thought that was my problem. Okay, now I remember what you said that I liked. And what it was is that it is a successful day if you haven't taken a drink or something like that, and I agree with that. When I first got sober and started remaining sober, I couldn't believe it. I was incredulous. It was amazing to me that I had gone a week and then a couple of weeks and then a month and then a couple of months without a drink. And I'm not kidding you when I mean this. There was a part of me from my first year of sobriety that thought, I am probably still drinking, but like I'm sort of blocking it out of my memory, almost like I have another personality that drinks on weekends maybe, and I'm just blacking it out. And I'm not kidding. It's not that I thought that was happening, but I thought there was a good chance that it might be because I could not believe that I was staying sober. It was amazing to me. And I stayed sober. And the thing is this, after that first year, I had been doing something for the first time in my life. I had done something consistently for a year. I had gone to meetings. I had a sponsor. I was working the steps with that sponsor. The steps were confusing to me. They're what kept me out of AA. I'm not a religious person. I never have been. I'm not now. And I thought, incorrectly, if you're new, that if I came here, I would have to become a religious person. I have nothing against religion or anything. It's not that. It's just that it just wasn't what blew my hair back, right? So what I found that when I got here is that I could work this program in a way that works that works for me, you know, and this was very important to me. And the only things I'll say about the second and the third step where they talk about God is that, and these are the only two things, hopefully, because everything else would be an opinion. I don't want to share those, is that if you have a way that you view spirituality when you come in here, you shouldn't ever be asked not to use that. And equally, if you should never be asked to do it any particular way. That's the other thing. You know, this is something that we come in here and we embrace in a way that makes sense to us. And I thought that was very, very important. And I came in and I started working the steps. And what happened was, this is the way I explain it, there was a void inside me that alcohol filled so perfectly ever since that first time I drank when I was in that Club Med in the Bahamas, in Eleuthera. There was a hole, and it had this magic feeling when that void was filled with alcohol, everything just was okay. But it, obviously, I couldn't keep it up, and it stopped working. And what I have found that as a result of working the steps, that void is filled. It's definitely different than taking a drink, okay? Because the thing is, if I'm sad, I'm going to feel sadness, and if I'm lonely, I'm going to feel lonely, and all that. But the thing is, so far in 17 years, I've been able to deal with it. I've had some really tough times, but I have been able to deal with it. The most important point I want to make is this: I worked my ass off to stay drunk, to stay high, whatever I was doing. I worked my ass off for that. It really, I was, without really meaning to, I was completely 100% committed to that. I thought I should be able to just be sober, and it never worked out. The reason I got sober is because I started working for it. I started to nurture my sobriety, and I've nurtured it for 17 years. I have not, my life has changed in 17 years, but my program has not. I go to a few meetings every week. I go to the same meetings every week. I go to a couple less meetings now than when I first got sober, but that's the only thing that stopped. I have never gone without meetings except when I travel, and I do travel a lot for fun. I go out of the country. I just love traveling. And sometimes I go to meetings. Sometimes I don't, especially if it's like in Asia or something like that. Sometimes I don't go to meetings. But I do. I've been to, whenever I'm here, I go to meetings. I take care of my sobriety. I try to put it first. And I say try. I've actually succeeded in 17 years. I put my sobriety first. I build a life around it. I learned in AA how to be consistent and have been able to use that lesson and extrapolate it in my life so that I can do things like go back to school. And I did that. I went to school, got a degree. I have a career based around that degree, and I really like it. So I worked hard to stay out there, and I want to make this clear. I have to work hard to be sober, too. But the good news is I don't have to work a twentieth as hard as I have to work to stay drunk. That's just my my experience. Now, I don't mean I don't work very hard. It's consistent. I do something every day for my program. It's not always a meeting, but I do something every day, and I've done those things every day for 17 years. And what I have found is if I put that first, if I do what I need to do to nurture whatever part of me it is that fills that void, whatever part of my life it is that fills that void, it's not that I'm happy all the time, but I do get to choose whether or not to take a drink. It has never in 17 years been so bad that I've had to take a drink. And that's a real gift. And I want to make it clear before I sit down, I'm about to, that AA, my life's really great. It really is. And I don't, AA doesn't give me everything. What it does is it gives me a blank slate upon which I can, you know, do whatever I choose to do. I don't think I'd have any of this without AA, but I'm just saying that it took work. It's not like I just got sober and then everything turned out the way I wanted it to. It's there have been life lessons along the way, and that's what I love about AA. But the one thing I'll say, the most important thing I've done is work my program consistently, not constantly, but consistently. And that's why I do things like this, even though I gain no instantaneous pleasure from it, because I have to work for my sobriety. And just for me, I do it in AA. That's how I do it. So I've always done it for 17 years. And so ultimately, I'm glad to be here sharing my story. Thanks for letting me share.